So, it's time for Lingua Franca again with me, Maria Zylstra. Hello. And in this week before the Radio National summer begins, and while all Victorians are being asked by mail by their Premier to be sure to be fire ready for this year's fire season, with last year still in the forefront of our consciousness, here's Jim McNamara from South Australia, who's been pondering this fire-prone land where we live, to advocate for the adoption of another word into our general vocabulary, which, though the word is not novel, since it's been here longer than the English language has, it's one that we truly need for the circumstances in which we live. Until recently, Jim McNamara worked as a curatorial officer in the fossils section of the Museum of South Australia and has an interest in sustainable land use. Here he is to explain.
We English speakers have available to us something in the order of 500,000 words, if we include scientific and technical terms. Despite this, I am here today to suggest that we here in Australia need to borrow an extra one in order to replace a descriptive phrase that just feels inadequate. Early this year, I wrote a letter to the editor to put this case. I shall read it to you. We need to name this thing. That Saturday morning, the 7th of February 2009, I was sitting inside our home at Two Wells, north of Adelaide, watching the hot northwest wind doing its damage to our garden. During the morning, our best banana plant, growing on top of our soakage pit, the only place around here that such a thing could grow, sagged and slowly lay down till it was flattened onto the ground. By noon, the air temperature was 45.3 degrees Celsius under our veranda, and I was inside, under the ceiling fan, feeling knackered. For the first time that I can remember in my 50-plus summers, I have resorted this year to stepping under the cold shower in my underwear and then emerging dripping wet to sit under the fan to really cool off. It works. But even so, on that day, I was relieved but left stunned when the cool change came in early. Just after midday, the breeze was from the south and about 10 degrees cooler. That was more than enough for me, and that same weather system carried on over Victoria with the result we are currently trying to come to terms with. Knowing that a fire did start just a few kilometres away from us did not help. Halfway through that morning, I grasped the nagging thought I had often had, that we need a better name for this bastard wind. The hot northwesterly is not adequate for this killer. The Californians have their Santa Anas, the Mediterraneans have their Siroccos, but what have we got? After 172 years, Adelaideans have not come up with much. What about the older people? So clad in my damp t-shirt and jocks, I sat at my labouring laptop and emailed a couple of colleagues of mine at the South Australian Museum, both anthropologists of note. By that afternoon, I had a reply from one of them, directing me to the Kaurna word Wotabakara. In 1840, the Lutheran missionaries Tickleman and Sherman recorded its meaning as northwest wind, tempestuous weather. They also have Bakara, northwesterly wind, which is very hot during summer and indicates a storm. This is more like it. What are the word's roots? I'm not a linguist, but the same book, which was published in Adelaide as Outlines of a Grammar, Vocabulary and Phraseology of the Aboriginal Language of South Australia, spoken by the natives in and for some distance around Adelaide, and is still available as a copy from Google, tells me that water means behind, and gara is the red gum tree, with other meanings of high, sky and heaven. I guess it was the biggest, strongest thing around in their environment, as it often still is in ours. Even if I have the etymology wrong, notions of getting behind the red gum under these conditions sound reasonable to me. These smooth-bark stalwarts resist burning, too. They drop their limbs usually on still mornings during droughts, as many of us know, but that is just a reminder that the real world is all around us, and I suppose the old fellas would have had a word for that, too. Whether this word Bakara catches on or not would depend upon wider publication and usage, of course. Or we could do it the hard way and evolve a word of our own. Just as Rose Hill parakeets became Rose Hillers and eventually Rosellas, I suppose the hot northwest wind might become the Honolly, or the stinkin' Honolly, in time. What is it about words? They are the tools we use to convey meaning. In choosing a word, the speaker wishes to convey a meaning to the listener or the writer to the reader. But straight away, we have the problem of which meaning is attached to the individual word itself, ignoring emphasis, stress, and context, and all the embellishments of the speaker, writer, or reader. Meaning exists in three phases: the meaning the speaker or writer has in mind, the meaning that comes into the mind of the listener or reader, with the intervening phase being the meaning or meanings that can be attached to the particular word, or the dictionary meaning. What can we do in choosing words to avoid confusion or misinterpretation, or to refine meaning, so that what we wish to be understood is understood? There are at least four choices. We can select a word closest to our desired meaning. We can substitute a word to move meaning in a desired direction. If no suitable word is at hand, we can borrow one from another language or invent a new one to suit. The other thing we can do is choose to omit words entirely and so, possibly, influence discussion and thought, perhaps profoundly. I've tried my hand at new words before, in particular by inventing a new word from existing word roots in order to describe something new that was related to a group of already existing things. In this case, land use systems. The word was maxiculture and relates to the agriculture family of words that now includes horticulture, silviculture, floriculture, and aquaculture, among others, denoting the culture or farming of particular classes of things. My word belongs more particularly to the series monoculture, polyculture, and permaculture, denoting increasing levels of complexity in the system, and would lie at this end of the series as its practice involves maximising useful plant diversity and other things. Just choosing a word may seem easy, but that is not to say it is unimportant or not in some way influential. For example, the people who described a new plant disease that I worked on were aided by the fact that most of us attach particular meaning to the word disease, namely the idea that if it is a disease, it is also infectious, and that the infection is likely due to the action of a microbe. That the people using the word were microbial plant pathologists and so interested in finding their particular class or classes of microbial pathogens was and is not trivial. I became concerned with this matter through an insight or understanding that the environment of the sick trees had become toxic and that they had, quite probably, been poisoned through their roots. When it came time for me to write an article about them, I chose the title Mandala Yellows, a Simple Case of Poisoning, which could not have been more explicit. One editor described it as brutally blunt. As it transpired, the discussion, dominated as it was by the technical authorities, continued to use the established set of words, with disease, pathogen, infection, and even epidemic peppering the popular and specialist literature. It is only partly mollifying to know that, technically, disease can be caused by things other than microbes, and that a pathogen can be a chemical agent. Unfortunately, though, this is not the most readily assumed meaning of the word. So this selection of words can be seen to have functioned to draw readers and listeners away from considerations of environmental toxicology. Choice of words can be unwise, as can be seen in the almost immediate use of the word unprecedented to describe the 7th of February 2009 bushfires. Perhaps it was a function of the extreme youth of the swaggering pups of the press, ignorance, or a mistake induced by shock. Whatever its origin, it was quickly applied and widely used to describe the Holocaust we now call the Black Saturday bushfires, in recognition of their close and many-faceted comparability with particularly the horrendous Black Friday bushfires of January 1939, but also the Black Thursday fires of the 6th of February 1851. Many of us, of course, remember two Ash Wednesday fires, with the first in February 1983. Then again, one might expect commentators to recall the Whangarei fire that burned much of Eyre Peninsula in early 2005, driven by the same old Wātāpākara weather pattern. I'm sorry to say that while these huge bushfires are very bad, if not the worst in the world, they are not, in any useful sense, unprecedented. When I was involved in that ecological project centred on the unwise use of herbicides, I encountered a whole nest of substituted or substitutable words that have been applied for differing effect. What the technologically minded might call herbicides were once popularly called weed killers, or weed poison, in the days when arsenic was kept handy. In latter, more effete times, the sensitive modern soul might simply spray their weeds, or be said to be doing a bit of weed control. How often these days do we hear the word control substituted, at least in part, for the word kill? A tired mother will one day soon innocently ask for new ways to control her unruly children, to be met by horrified expressions from her audience. The weed killer case is one of word substitution to alter the received meaning in a preferred direction, but is also one of omission, since the words poison and kill are seldom uttered in this context. When listening to and reading the accounts of the Black Saturday bushfires, and particularly seeing the images of devastated towns and dwellings, I was mindful of some commonplace, everyday words that were not being used. They were, and I suspect still are, weatherboard homes upon stumps. These seem a most obvious chain of descriptors, both from my memory of childhood travels with my parents in that wonderful part of the world, the tall forest country of eastern Victoria, and from the photographic evidence of burnt-out remains. That heap of warped corrugated roof iron amid remnants of stumps, if they were concrete, or charred pits if they were timber. Pitiful though these images are, do not these words best represent the reality that must be coped with? Next time, in the worst fire country on earth, when the dreaded Wātāpākara is howling in our ears, will we think it reasonable to expect the survival of a tender dry wooden box held up above the mothering earth, allowing the hot draft beneath? The right words might help us cope, even survive, a harsh reality if they direct our thoughts to, rather than away from, truth.
Jim McNamara of Two Wells, north of Adelaide. You'll find the transcript of his talk, as well as further information, on the Lingua Franca website at abc.net.au/rn/linguafranca. I'm Maria Zylstra, letting you know that over the next few weeks now, you can hear a series of highlights from the past year during ABC Radio National summer. Though, of course, there is still a mass of audio and other info available online. Thank you for your communications, kind and critical, over the past year. And it's not too late, you know, to drop me a line before the year's out. Looking forward to another E in 2010. Okie dokie.